This is the title slide. And we're talking about some emerging research we're doing. And in the context of this talk, we're going to introduce the problem, talk about some of the data gathering methods we're using, and some of the analysis we're doing. Talk about how we're using agent-based simulation to try to analyze and get a handle on some of the phenomena going on here, and then tell you where we're going. So, that there's a gap between how computers are built, computing systems are built, and how they're used. And in particular, in the context of cybersecurity, there's, Avi mentioned earlier, RBAC. I remember a security officer from a large Wall Street firm telling me, laughing, "You computer scientists think that we can put everybody in a room, stop the company for 2 weeks, and actually figure out our role-based policy." So there's a huge gap here. And another thing with insecurity, we often think of, oh, we have to stop the adversaries. They're the ones who do bad things. When the reality, in many situations, it's not the adversary. It's the good users trying to get their job done, and in many cases trying to do things like save patient lives, who are engaging in the workarounds. So our security engineering, all our great thinking, doesn't do any good if it's based on a fantasy that, oh, everybody actually follows the rules. Now, healthcare is a particularly interesting area in this regard. Autonomy and authority. In other words, clinicians think they're gods. There's a very strong value, sense of mission is life and death. We had somebody ask us, are you here to help patients, or do you just want to build a better policeman? And there's a lot of variation from location to location, that each scenario, each even different departments within a hospital can be very different. But again, it's not that special in that other domains, application domains, share a lot of these properties and give rise to some of these problems. And we're looking at those as well as part of this broader project, Shucks, Science of Human Circumvention of Security. So, Ross.
Tag, you're it.
So, earlier we talked about premature logout and premature log in. So there are two speeds for logging out, too soon and too late. And if you do it too soon, then you interrupt the work that's being done. If you do it too late, you create a vulnerability. So what some people did is they put a proximity indicator on the computers themselves. But the problem is that doctors and nurses don't do medicine the way the IT department thought. They walk away, they test the patient, they talk to the patient, they find a document. So what everybody did is they used this device, high-tech, and they put it on top of all of the proximity indicators, thus defeating them, leaving the system used. Another workaround we saw is in New York State, a death certificate must be accompanied by the thumbprint of the doctor writing the death certificate. So one group at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, it turned out that of the about 14 doctors in that group, only one doctor's thumbprint was readable by the digital device. So if you die between 135th Street and about 58th Street on the east side of Manhattan, this one doctor will be the signature of your death. Last case, many of you know about barcode medication administration, and in this case, every medication is supposed to have a barcode, and you're supposed to scan it. But the reality is that the codes don't work the way they were thought about when they designed the system. My favorite one being when the pharmacy covers the barcode with a decal reminding the nurse to scan the barcode. So what people do is they work around these problems. They enter it separately. What we're doing is we're doing a heck of a lot of observations and interviews, and we have to do these because people don't see the workarounds that are ubiquitous in their lives. Sometimes they're taught these workarounds as part of their training. This is the way we do this. We're also doing those other things. And very importantly, we have developed a questionnaire the URL link we're going to display, which I promise you, you will find very interesting to complete. It takes about 4 minutes, and we want you to complete it. It can be, it's done anonymously, so there's no problem with that. We want you to complete it, and we want you to get everybody else to complete it. And if you let us know, we'll create a subfile and share the data with you so you can see what your people are saying. We have some IT people who are really excited about this and are using it to gain feedback to make their systems more responsive. Remember that not only are workarounds pandemic, they're also so pandemic that they're not seen. They're really hiding in plain sight. But the problem is that people focus on the workarounds not as the problem, but as They focus on workarounds rather than the causes of the workarounds. And that is a very stupid way to go about this. And now my colleagues will continue.
Actually, okay, we're going to continue. And these are other sources besides the, different ways we're getting observation, analyzing help desk logs, all sorts of fun things. And again, it's interesting. Once you get low enough in the hierarchy, people tell you everything. Okay, so we're gathering data. Some of the things we're doing with the data is looking at it, trying to understand patterns, and analyze that. And it's always nice to have simple drawing. So one pattern we see is, gosh, a security officer, as you can tell, they have a badge there. They see that their system is in some configuration. They would like it to be in a more secure configuration. And from their understanding of how the system works, too many computers on wheels are left logged in unattended, so I will dial down the timeout from which an unattended one gets automatically logs out, and that will make me more secure. So they have this idea that, I'll just change the dial, and I'll increase security, and security will get better. And, of course, the reality, as shown in many cases, is often the real world disagrees. You make your timeout tighter, people get pissed off, they break the system. Or another case here is adding in one EMR where, we'll make it easier for the attending to bless the residents' reports. We'll give one button that they can bless all of them. And so, one button. Blesses all of them, the reports are not read anymore. So we call this the uncanny descent. In computer graphics, there's an idea of an uncanny valley. As you make things more realistic, there's a period in which the viewer regards it as strange and weird and not helpful. Though it's a descent, not a valley, because we don't know if it actually gets better if you tighten the security even more. Now this lets us, these couple elements here, is similar to a framework that we used in an earlier study on medical usability of HIT, we got these kind of three elements we're thinking about: the clinician's mental model about what's going on in reality, the actual medical reality, this disease, the sickness, the state of the human, and then its representation in the information technology. Although we can go one up in over the old medieval Europe thing and actually have, there is a connection directly from the representation of the medical reality as well as between the clinician's mental model. So we use this, Ross and I use this as a framework to look at audio usability issues, and we thought it was clever, but in fact, there's nothing new under the sun. You can find this in 1927 in semiotics, with slightly different terminology, but the idea that, there's what you think, what's in the communicator's head, the representation in the sign system, that's the computer configuration, the security policies, the things, and then the actual reality. So, using this framework to look at circumvention, you can think, the officer has something in their head about the policy they want, the behavior they want in the system for access control or whatever, or timeouts. They configure the system that way. That configured system causes a reality to happen. The officer is quite happy. But then there's this clinician, and her perception of the reality doesn't match what she thinks it ought to be. But, you know, she can, so there's a frown indicate that she's not happy. But she can add some additional functionality, some of her own signs to the sign system here. And that changes the behavior of the system to make her happy, but breaks the triangle of the original officer. This is a basic illustration. We have a lot of patterns and a lot of things coming out of this. So next steps here in the analysis. Corpus. It's fun to say that word. Corpus. We have about 300 right now items of circumventions and other kinds of interesting mismatches in a bunch of areas. A lot of emerging patterns. Cross-channel where an officer can do something on one site that completely changes in a negative way the security posture of a completely unrelated site, where there's a clinician who is trying to follow the rules both of her medical officer, I mean the IT officer in her medical installation, as well as the ethics that say she has to share data to get a second opinion. A root for a lot of this, if we go back to semiotics again, they talk about morphisms. Structure preserving mappings between the nodes of this triangle. And in many cases, we can find, you know, mismorphisms, where there's a failure to preserve this natural structure is what gives rise to a lot of these problems. Our ultimate aspiration here, again, is not just to find all the problems, here's a lot of problems in the world, but also, you know, by systematic classification, maybe we can actually start doing some systematic countermeasures. Now, again, it gets complicated, but, you know, we have lots of complicated systems that are behaving in interesting ways, humans that are behaving in interesting ways, and what we're looking for out of this is not the not the behavior of an individual human, but this aggregate, you know, what is the net badness in the system overall when all this stuff happens? Observation is one way to get it, but another set of tools would be...
Another avenue that we're looking at is agent-based simulation. So basically here we have a coded representation of a human, and they're acting in a virtual world. And so we'll run these simulations and hopefully have some insights from them. So why are agent-based simulations useful? We can model fairly complex scenarios. So we can, in a health hospital setting, we might have multiple clinicians, patients, security folks that are interacting with one another. They're using multiple machines, devices, computers. They have different software running on these computers. We can also model fairly complex objective functions. So we can talk about security risks associated with compromised patient data. We can talk about non-security risks as well, such as lost clinician time, or we might talk about we might also talk about other things. Generally, we're dealing with situations where analytical reasoning is difficult and. Testing out in the real world is laden with risks, and it's costly. So the types of things that we might want to model are inconsistencies with a security policy and the workflow, or we might want to gauge inclination to circumvent, even if we don't know any kind of particular circumventive techniques that users might apply. So when we're doing simulations, we first want to understand what the scenario is like, so we'll want to understand how users act, what the security policy is, what security mechanisms are in place, how users interact with those mechanisms. We'll then want to extract the relevant factors that we think would be useful in a simulation. We can then generate mental models and determine what kind of things we'd actually like to measure. From there, we can actually program the agents and program the scenario, run simulations, and then analyze the results that we get. Once we do that, we can see whether the results we get match data points that we already have, and if they don't, we can tweak the simulation a bit and then go through this process again until we have a simulation that seems to work for the data points that we have, and then we can start exploring new topics. So Jim will talk a little bit more about Dash.
Okay, so how can we build human agents that within the software allow us to model this idea of a workaround, which is something, the agent's doing things that we didn't expect, right? That doesn't seem to make sense. So one way that we're going about this is through this agent framework. So this is the framework we use for a blank agent, a blank human-like agent, on which we layer on top plans and goals, ways of achieving their plans, and the beliefs about the world they're in and the security system that they're in, that they have. And on top of that, we start to build up these simulations. But even as a blank agent, this agent template gives us a lot of behaviors that help us to model different kinds of workarounds. So first of all, rather than being agents that just follow through scripts, these are using a reactive planning system, so they're programmed with goals, and they create their own plans, their own ways to achieve the goals that they have, and then they continuously evaluate their plans to see if they're doing what they want to do. So if the world changes, if something unexpected happens, they'll actually replan and try to do something else. It makes them much more flexible, so as humans are, they'll find ways to achieve what they want to do. It also gives them the option to circumvent, to find a workaround. Another piece of modeling here is what's called a dual process model of cognition. So instead of having just the one part in the agent, which is doing all this logical stuff, the things that we're aware of doing, like creating plans and following them, there's a second piece, which is a more instinctive sort of gut reaction, sort of an urge to take an action when you see a situation. And so that's always there as well, sometimes in conflict with the rational part of these agents. We can use that to be able to program in, for example, differences in behavior when an agent gets tired or when emotions run high, which emotions can emerge as part of the gut reaction piece. And also if the agent perceives it to have, you know, too many tasks going on or it's sort of under time constraints. So this allows us to build agents which are going to set out with the idea of doing the right thing in the world, but they're going to take shortcuts if they see that they have to or if they get tired. And all these agents then are interacting with each other both directly and through the world in which they have, say, contention for certain resources, like these computers that they might be logged onto. So some of the things we've looked at so far in this scenario include, the BCMA system, that was the barcode medical system. But in particular, we were looking at agents that have to go through a fairly complex workflow, do this sort of hand washing, this hygiene that we've talked about, a certain set of steps that they need to do, and then we want to say, well, is that actually tenable, given the set of tasks they have to do, given the environment they're in, where there might be a certain contention for these resources? And that's something we can look at, and then we can also gauge for these agents, you know, the frustration they're going to have, and then the propensity they're going to have to find shortcuts, which may not be the ones that are sanctioned. The second thing we've been looking at is, again, this auto logout, this timeout structure. So sometimes without sort of going back and getting the original data, we're not necessarily sure that an agent simulation is going to give you sort of real data on the exact proper value of the timeout, but we can find a lot of information about the shape of that timeout utility. So for example, the probability that somebody's going to get very frustrated based on the number of people who are contending for a different resource, that the cost of staying logged in, which depends on the number of other agents who are around during a particular simulation, this gives us a much clearer idea of the shape of these curves. And we can build up information that then lets us go back into the world and figure out what exactly we need to be looking for to make sure we're getting the right information to set something like a logout timeout, for example. So in these simulations, we're looking at this kind of information. We're also able to ask a lot more sort of what-if questions. Both what if we added more training or sort of tried to educate users better or to put out there better ideas about security hygiene? What if we imposed more stringent sanctions? We can look at the way that interacts with both getting people to do the right thing, but also increasing frustration levels or distrust in the IT group. Other things we're looking at is what if you go back and treat these workarounds as, in fact, a symptom and try to improve the conditions, improve the conditions that led to these workarounds? Would that work better? What if we try to improve the policies that we're using? Okay.
So this is ongoing work, and it's ongoing, collecting more data and continuing with the work on this. And again, what we're trying to find out in general is, you know, what do circumventions, what works in practice, and what's the science behind it? Because we have a problem, it's got to get solved, we need to do a better job in what we're doing. And I'm not going to read these slides, but these are some of the, you know, some of the things we're seeing. And yeah, we want to, in the long run, figure out a way to do a better job with security engineering here by taking into account how humans actually behave. Okay, well, you know, lots of interesting thoughts here. Some initial publications talking about some of the initial discovery, you know, just some initial taxonomies and issues here. We don't really get into the simulation stuff yet because that's still ongoing. And thank you very much.
All right, so we have time for a quick question. We're actually running over for lunch, but Carl.
How do you decide when something is a workflow, a workaround, versus it's being an ordinary anticipated branch in the workflow? So an example with barcodes is I occasionally give lectures on barcodes, comparing them to RFIDs and so on. And one of the anticipated problems was that, you know, there might be some smudge on the barcode, and so you put the numbers on there so they can be entered directly. And you could view this as just a, you know, fault-tolerant mechanism for dealing. It's not a workaround. It's the way they were intended to work.
Well, that example with the numbers is really adopting the workaround into the workflow itself so that it's no longer a workaround. If the process has been changed, which ideally it is, then it ain't a workaround. Workarounds are variations or deviations from accepted, from agreed policy.
So is reading a barcode, is typing in the barcode numbers a workaround, or is it an accepted policy?
If it's taught as part of the system, then it's not a workaround, but it's stunningly inefficient compared to the original design of what it was. It's a pathetic workaround that's been embodied into the policy. It's a dumb workaround that's become accepted, but it's still, it's now kosher.
Can I add something to that real quick?
Yeah.
I think we're also, you know, very aware that the term workaround itself is very hard to pin down and define, and that there are some gray areas. And even the definition of workaround that we just gave implies that there's some other person that had some particular view, and there might be multiple stakeholders. So we realize it's a lot more complex than just saying this is a workaround, this isn't, but there's a space to investigate.
Well, let's thank this fine quartet on their presentation.